Wait, wait, stop, that's the one.
Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being, to be true to yourself and be honest with others. Today we have a guest. Our guest today is Master Vincent Furrer. Master Vincent is a yoga and Qigong master with over 15 years of teaching experience. Furthermore, he is certified Reiki master teacher and certified minister. He is a herbalist and practitioner of natural medicine. He is also an author, an artist, and many wonderful things. And he will share all of that with us today. Also on the show notes, we'll have all these YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn, all these links on the show notes. And Master Vincent strives to guide other people towards spiritual enlightenment through education and inspiration. So I'm so glad to have him here today, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Zen. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you for the touch, too. Like, nervous. Who are you and what brings you joy?
Well, who am I? So you have your brain, your spirit, your psyche, but really what we are is a soul. So the persona and the spirit are the intermediaries between the soul and this world. And when you become self-realized, you realize that you're the soul, which is found the inner right side of the heart. What brings me joy? Many things bring me joy. From a physical level, I like walking, hiking, doing yoga, reading, music, eating, things like this. But from the spiritual level, you're coming inward, and getting more and more joy away from just the earthly pleasures. Mm. So the bliss and the joy, spiritual bliss, nirvana, is found within. So the less that you rely on the physical world for your happiness, the more blissful that you become.
Nice. Yes, nice. I read the Book of Joy through Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, I think it was. And he talks about that, how exactly what you say, people rely on the outside. And it's a practice to learn to rely on the inside, because there's so much outside and people are teaching us to do the things on the outside. So beautiful.
Oh, yeah. By the way, rest in peace. God bless Desmond Tutu. It's a big loss. But in the yoga, there's eight limbs. So the way that it was taught, and Buddha teaches the Eightfold Path, yoga teaches the eight limbs. After many years of study, you can do either one. It'll take you to the same destination. There's slight differences, but it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And the fourth one is pratyahara. Pratyahara means when you start withdrawing your senses away from the physical world and then inwards towards the self. Mm. So whatever you put into your brain is considered food, anything. Mm-hmm. And with pratyahara, you're starving the brain of all of these things so that it releases them, and you detox from it, and the brain can become still. So, for example, if we're watching Netflix 4 hours a day and we're watching very high-paced, violent, emotional, stirring programming, then the brain gets caught up in these things, and it's very hard to have peace and calmness and happiness. So when you start to starve the brain of these high-paced, fast-moving, violent-oriented films, then you'll start to see that you have peace.
Yes, definitely. I see that. And if you... Well, I don't know how involved you are in the world, but when there's a mass shooting, people tend to want to blame video games or music. And so there's a comeback thing where saying, oh, it's what they watch. And people are denying that what you feed your brain can have an effect. And I've noticed when I listen to some music and I'm getting that energy of that music, and I was like, without knowing, it's subconsciously and you're doing it. So when I listen to a lot of, I have a list on Spotify, I call it Zen playlist, and there's like a lot of Hindu and Buddhist music and all the stuff from India, and I feel so totally different, at peace, I feel joy, and I rather listen to those more and classical. The only time I listen to anything else like pop whatever is when I do workout, because it's like anything with appropriateness. When I do workout, I need that like push and pump and...
Yes, yes. And, yeah. The excitement, high vibes. Definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So the outside world... So you need to be in that space where the outside world doesn't basically dictate how you're feeling in here. But how about if you let things... Because when I ask some people what brings them joy, people will say things up from the outside. Can you still have that? And if you lose that, is it okay? Because like... I use things on the outside that brings me joy, and I know how to find the ones inside as well. But when the outside things are gone, I still can have the joy. But that's okay. That's possible.
It's great. So this is really good. So what is the purpose of life? So the purpose of life is to enjoy life. So when the Creator gave us this existence, we can enjoy what life is, this creation. So that is the purpose of life. So if you're enjoying life, that's good. Mm-hmm. The other thing is to liberate the soul from earthly attachments. So if we have the life and we're not enjoying it, then that's a problem. So why aren't we enjoying it? Mm-hmm. And that's why it's important to understand what the purpose is. It's called Kaivalya, Nirvana, liberation. Mm-hmm. And it's over time to liberate your soul from samsara. Samsara is pain and pleasure, like and dislike, desire and aversion. Then from here, there's no... substitute for the eight limbs, because the sixth limb is one-pointed mindfulness and concentration. See, so when the Eightfold Path was given to us, it's described for all beings. It doesn't discriminate, and it doesn't matter what kind of being you are or where you're at in your spiritual development. The Eightfold Path is the way to go, and the one-pointed mindfulness and concentration can take a long time to build up. Mm-hmm. But the only way to keep yourself from falling back into that fear, that anxiety, that worry, that attachment, that greed, is to constantly develop the one-pointed concentration. Then the seventh limb is calming and stilling the mind and calming the heart. But it says the yogi has to know what is the yogi's intellect and what is the yogi's soul. And that's what I see... it's not being taught enough out here. How come nobody's saying, well, look, this is your brain. Your brain has intellect. Your brain has eye consciousness. But this is your soul. So you're not just your body and you're not just your mind. You're this. And I think it's important to say you're either realized or you're not realized. There's no in between. If you're a realized being, it means that you've realized that there is something in your heart, and it's what came into your body, and it's what's going to leave your body if... you bardo, because I hate to use the word death because it's just another transition. So if you bardo, this is what's going to leave your body. And with this practice, it's very deeply as you're preparing for death. But in what I teach, there are longevity practices. These longevity practices can extend your life to a very long time. And as far as how long it can extend your life, it's unseen, because the practices that I'm teaching are new.
Mm-hmm. Wow. The podcast started because I had some shame and guilt and judgments and fear, just like most people. And as of 2020, we had ourselves to look at in the mirror. And so I had a lot of those in 2020. So I started the podcast to help myself overcome those. And I've talked to many other people who are working on the same to overcome them. So How can one overcome shame, guilt, fear, and judgment?
So in the yoga, there's five yamas and five niyamas.
What's a yama? Yeah.
They're the internal observances and the moral and ethical code. They're the do's and do nots. Mm-hmm. The first niyama is purity. So when you enjoy something, okay, when you enjoy Thai food, mm-hmm. I love Thai food.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with the fact that you enjoy Thai food. You want to have a happy life. You want to have a good life. But when you enjoy it, your brain likes that. And then when your brain likes it, it's drawn to more desire for that. So purity takes place when you start to meditate for long periods of time. And the attachments that are on your heart, that are on your soul, they begin to slowly melt away until your brain becomes clear and your heart becomes pure. So the thing is anger is anger. Hatred is hatred. Right and wrong is right and wrong. So if somebody asks what is right, what is wrong, then yes, this is what's right, this is what's wrong. But that doesn't mean that we should hate each other. Because we're all on a path to the goal, which is spiritual enlightenment. Which is why teaching the traditional and classic ways that was written to us is the way to go. This book is non-judgmental, it's non-biased, it doesn't know race, it doesn't know color, it doesn't know religion. It's a spiritual guide for all beings on how to get to the goal. And understanding what the goal is an important thing. And the eight limbs are our lifestyle. So you're practicing each one. So what are the eight limbs? The first one is just calming your body and keeping your body strong and firm. And that builds up the strength of your central nervous system. Mm-hmm. The fourth limb is pranayama, which means to focus on the breath. It means to build your internal energy. And it means to exercise your breath. And in what I teach, it goes into internal alchemy and it goes into these other breathing techniques, which are extremely important. Then the fifth limb is pratyahara. We talked about that, bringing the senses inward. Then the sixth limb is concentration. Then the seventh limb is calming the mind and stilling the heart. And then samadhi, and again, the Buddhists call it jhana states. The yogis call it samadhi. So the Buddhists and the yogis, the Buddhists were like, we want our own word. We don't want your word. And the yogis were like, well, we're going to use our word. So they could have used the same word. They could have just said, this is nirvana, this is samadhi, this is... So samadhi is a culmination of the previous seven limbs. So when you're developed in your concentration, you're purifying your heart, and you're starving the senses and bringing them inward, a reaction happens and the elements in your body begin to change and your aura field becomes bright, and then you become absorbed in the present moment, mind, body, and soul. And that's nirvana. Mm. So I think if people understood this, it's not offensive. And another thing I run into is it's a belief. It's not a belief. This is spiritual science. This is exactly what it is. So yes, you're supposed to find out for yourself, is this true or is this false? But closed-mindedness is a hindrance to spiritual enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Stubbornness is a hindrance to spiritual enlightenment. But strong-mindedness is essential. So really understanding this is stubborn and closed-mindedness, but this is strong-mindedness. So then it's, well, what is the fundamentals of right and wrong? And that's where the five yamas come into play. The first one is ahimsa, which means not to harm anything. If you're not harming anything, then the rest of your moral and ethical codes will fall into balance. And for me, that includes not harming animals, which is vegetarianism. Mm. The second one is honesty. And the third one is not stealing. So these three fundamental moral and ethical codes are what set the balance for the rest of the moral and ethical codes. Now, if you're feeling guilty or you're feeling shamed because of your past actions, then you need to recognize that within yourself. Accept yourself for your actions and what you've done, and then practice your meditation and your loving kindness, and then your heart will purify and those guilts and those shames will go away. And then you're doing your best not to make any more mistakes. Mm. And that could be harsh because it's a very narrow path to not make any mistakes, and you gotta be uptight. So for that, calming the body and calming the mind and not acting so quick for things. Mm-hmm. But really, if you ask the Buddha what caused it, desire. Mm-hmm. So it all starts from desire. You know, we want something. Something is great, and there's nothing wrong with that. Then we get it, and we're so happy. It makes it. Then we want more. Then we want more. Then we lose it. Oh, I lost it. Oh, I can lose that. So calming the mind and stilling it from desire will naturally begin to clear up the other problems. So if you want to solve a problem, you have to eliminate its cause.
Yeah.
And you're eliminating the cause within yourself. If everybody lived this type of lifestyle, there would be a lot less suffering in the world. Because here you're telling people, look, your bliss and your joy are not just outside of you. There's nothing wrong with having possessions. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. But unless you come inside of yourself and find that bliss within your soul, you're never going to achieve true happiness. And then if you're harming other beings, if you're taking and taking and taking and you're not caring how that's affecting other beings, that's bad karma. And you can be rich in this life and you can come back next life poor. So it's good to be charitable. I say 3-10% of your income. This is, of course, if you have comfortable living. Mm-hmm. If you're struggling and you can't give away, that's fine. But if you have enough for yourself, 3-10% of your income should go towards charitable causes. Then if everybody gave 3-10% of their income towards charitable causes, then there would be no poverty on the earth. Mm-hmm. So the poverty is caused by two things. The first thing that it's caused by is by the person's own wrong actions, such as addiction, misusing their money, things like that. For that, even if you give somebody who's so addicted money, then is it really going to help them or not? So it, self-caused poverty is one cause through wrong action. Then the other type of poverty is caused by the greed of some people who are taking too much and not giving back. Mm-hmm. So those are the two main causes. And they stem from the fact of earthly attachments and lack of virtue.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you mentioned the first one, a lot of people like to blame the second one more. Because people like to blame things outside of themselves. And I'm someone, I like to face on my faults straight on. So I'm like, okay, because I would say myself when I had a poverty set up mindset, or when I was in debt, or when I couldn't have this or that, it was because of me. And I would say to people, like, don't blame. I was like, it's not a blaming myself, it's recognizing where I'm faulting about it. And when I recognize that and I do different, then everything was fine because I didn't need to blame other people. And I'm living in the 20th century. I'm not in Jim Crow or 200 years where I could probably blame someone, but now it's all up to me. So
I like to stick to the book because it's a definitive guide. Mm-hmm. But what it says in the book, it says that God is perfect and that God's energy comes into you and God removes the obstacles that are within you like a farmer would remove dirt from an irrigation field. So basically, the reality as it is perfect, and it's removing your shortcomings as you're going through the time. And it's like being beach glass. If you throw some glass into the water there, then the water comes, and eventually the glass comes up. It's very finely rooted. Ooh. So that's kind of how it's described as we're throwing. Right now, we're in the ocean of samsara, and then the waves of the ocean are either going to make us smoother and perfect us, or they're going to break us and make us more jagged.
Mm-hmm. I read that you like nature and wilderness and things like that. Why is that important in your life or someone's life?
Well,
that's why I made it here because I can go out, but.
Well, first and foremost, it's healthy to be in nature, and it's essential for your aura field, and it's essential for your health. And fresh air is the most important thing that you could possibly have. The fresh oxygen, the fresh energy, the fresh prana is the most essential thing for your health. Without the air, you die in 60 seconds, maybe 6 to 9 minutes if you're a pro, you know. Uh-huh. when you're going out in nature, it's going to take all that stuff off your aura field, all the stuff that's in the airwaves, the cell phone, the radiation from the phones. That radiation's not good. When you go out in nature, it absorbs, the plants take in that radiation and it clears out your aura field. So it's extremely essential that we go out in nature. When you're in nature, you're communing with God, you're communing with the Creator. It's a good break from other high stimuli, and also since we're so packed in with each other, we're constantly in other people's aura fields all the time. When you go out there in nature, it gives you a time to kind of allow other people's energy to come out of you. I'm a very sensitive empath, so when you're around people all the time, 24/7, you have no time to really focus on yourself. Mm-hmm. Getting out in nature can kind of help with that.
That's so true. And I don't think, well, people could argue that, but I don't think anyone can argue it, because once you've gone there and you feel it, it's a knowing. It's not even a belief or things you have to hear. Yeah.
I'm happy you brought this up. The arguing thing, okay? So debates are good. Arguing is for idiots. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that the debates are there so that both people reach a higher understanding. Even if you're right in the debate, when you walk away, you should walk away with a higher understanding.
Right.
The problem is people are just arrogant and they just want to prove their point and that's it.
Right. Without taking, like, back and forth, yeah, exchanging.
But then there's, is it right or is it wrong? So one of my videos is called Belief or Fact, and that's one of the things I run into. Like, is there God? It's scientifically proven that there's God. So if it's scientifically proven that there's God 12 to 15 years ago, how come there's still atheists who say that there is no God, but it's been proven through logic? So when you look at the church around, let's see, 1500 to 1100, somewhere between those years, they said science is evil, no science. And they even hung people, killed people. But science was like, listen, I'm not going to take your God on blind faith. I'm going to need some kind more of a proof from that. So that is one of the main reasons that set science into motion. Then after that, Einstein came along, said E equals MC squared. After he said that, they're like, well, we don't believe you, Einstein. Einstein's like, look, the math is right here. The math doesn't lie. But still, even though Einstein was right, even though the math was right there, they had to wait for the eclipse of the moon to where they put the telescope up there and they saw the rays of light bend around the moon. And they said, okay, now Einstein is 100% right. You can't deny Einstein, right? So then after that, they saw the speed of space. They saw the speed of light. They saw the universe expanding. And they brought it back to the Big Bang. So now that's scientific fact at this point. So then it's, well, okay, if the universe came from one small, infinitely dense, infinitely hot point, and energy has to come from somewhere, and that's scientifically proven, then what the heck created this? And which means it was either created by accident or it was created by something with intelligence. Now, if you look at the laws that are in the universe, and these are laws, these are facts, these are not, they are unarguable. The law of thermodynamics, the law of gravity, the law of the speed of light. These are laws that are in the universe. If you say that those laws are not there, then you are wrong. There's no arguing that. The laws that hold the universe in place, that make this whole thing work, are so intelligent that if you do the mathematics, the odds of it being created by accident are less than 0.00001%. And the odds of it being created by something with intelligence are 99.9999999%. Mm-hmm. So it is scientifically proven that this was created by something. It was not created by accident. So then it's, oh, well, this was created by something with intelligence. Well, is it just one thing with intelligence, or are there many different types of creators, and how do they come into play? So then when you understand that, when you do God realization. So now, first, this is intellectually proven. This is not blind faith. This is intellectually proven. So understand that it's intellectually proven. Then with yoga, it's God realization. So the Tao and Yuj, in Chinese, Tao. So these masters, they weren't trying to complicate it for us. You went to one of these masters, he would say, Tao, One word, this big. And what he's describing is the whole totality of creation. So we can pin down many different little things in creation. We can take this book, we can break it down into atoms, we can break it down into chapters, we can go over each one. But it's almost like trying to empty the ocean onto the beach with a spoon. You're never really going to get that ocean onto the beach. So yoga yuj means realizing totality. When you realize totality and you meditate on God, it's called God realization. And they call God's energy jhakti. And the energy that's in your heart is a piece of the creator because it's consciousness itself. Then when you're focusing on the heart and you meditate on God, what are the obstructions that keep you from that? And that's what yoga is. It's union of everything. It's union of your mind. It's union of your body. It's union of your soul. It's union of your emotions. So you're harnessing in all of the aspects of yourself, the physical, the mental, the spiritual, the emotional. And then when you do that, you're increasing your focus and awareness. And then you're focusing on the universe and the multiverse itself. So the mind is only aware of what it is aware of in the moment. But because of our likes and our dislikes, we block certain things out and we put certain things in. What you're doing is you're taking the blinders off and you're seeing things for exactly what they are. And you're connecting to the universe and you're connecting to even further than that, the creator. And in yoga, they call his energy Shakti. So if you can imagine how much energy it takes to create a universe, right, to give you an idea of how powerful this Shakti energy is, just imagine light that's solid. Like you go to touch this light like this, and it's solid light. If you came anywhere close within the vicinity of this energy, the flesh would just right up.
So. Right. How about some people would say, okay, just living life, who cares? Because I was there at some point of my life too. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, suffering's going to happen. I'm just YOLO. And then we're going to die. Like, none of it matters. What would you tell these people?
I'd say that's a very good thing to contemplate. So mental attitude has a lot to do with it. I've taken the Bodhisattva vow. So this is the vow to end suffering. And I ask myself that question sometimes too. I just helped 50 people in the last week. Did it even make a difference? In the ocean of suffering, one drop of non-suffering does make a little bit of a difference. But if you count the grains of sand on a beach, there's so many grains of sand on one beach. Then if you count the beaches that are on the earth, how many grains of sand there are on the beaches that are on the earth? Then if you count all the planets in the galaxy, in the universe, and how many beaches and grains of sand there are in the entire universe. So there is suffering, and suffering does have a cause. Is it possible to eliminate suffering? I believe so. It takes place through education and through time. And one of my masters told me there are 74 different creations in the universe. I was told this now. And we're in the 73rd creation. And the 74th creation, there's no more physicality. There's only energy body. So if you think about the wholeness of creation and the 215 billion years of time, if you can wrap your head around that, then the evolution does lead us to a place where there might be no suffering. So the only way to do it is if everybody is understands what this is saying. So one of the issues that Buddha would run into is if he spoke about God, five different people had five different aspects of God, so they would argue about it. So that's why Buddha chose to not talk about God. I'm sure he did to his closest disciples in private and things like that if he wanted to. But you learn as a teacher, if I'm going to talk about this and five people are going to flip out on me, maybe I shouldn't talk about that, you know?
Or even when they're ready to, because some people are not wanting to. Ready as in like listening instead of arguing and I'm right. And so if people are like that, then I don't bother.
Then those people are causing their own suffering. And not only that, but they're causing the suffering of the other people. So we have to share this earth. So if I'm sitting right here fully enlightened in nirvana and there's 100 people over there who are slaughtering animals, going around with M16 shooting each other, we both live on the same earth. So therefore I'm suffering because of their unactions, because of their wrong actions. Which is why if you look at Thanos, he was willing to wipe out half the universe so that he could bring a state of balance and peace and harmony so that the children didn't want to suffer. In his mind, he was justified. And if the ends justify the means, then why not? But it's only through education that you can eliminate the full suffering on the earth. In this book, there's 196 sutras. These 196 sutras are core essential spiritual text. So our ancestors, when they died, when they were about to die, they said, you know what? They looked back at their lives and they said, this is what we need to tell our descendants so that we can stop their suffering. And the written word was a big deal in humankind. If you look back to when we were monkeys, we couldn't write things down. We had stone tools. When we started to be able to write things down and read it, that's a huge deal. And the fact that we can write things down is what makes us an evolved species as opposed to, say, a monkey or an octopus or an elephant. Okay? Now, when they wrote these books down, they were like, here, this is what you need to do to stop suffering. This is what you need to know. They made it very simple, very precise for us, and this is what they were dying. They left it to us on their dying deathbed. So for people to try to take away the authenticity of the text is very, very unwise. So that's very ignorant. And that's one of the reasons why we're going through this era in this age and this time. They were discrediting the teachings. Well, why do you think our ancestors wrote this stuff down for us? They didn't want us to go through this.
Right.
And it's perfected text. I mean, you could write it over 1,000 ways. There is no writing it over. They already did it perfect for us.
Right, yeah, yeah. Right, yeah. Why reinvent the wheel?
Sorry. Yeah.
So when did you start your search for enlightenment, and when did you obtain it?
The word enlightenment, to enlighten, means to bring light where there's darkness. So every day you're going through a cycle of enlightenment. To relieve ignorance is to gain knowledge where there wasn't knowledge before, and lack of knowledge causes suffering and pain.
Yeah.
I watched a kung fu flick where they had Buddhist warriors.
Like from the 70s?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, those, yeah, they were fun.
And so I was born Christian. when I saw the kung fu that the Buddhist monks could do, I was immediately turned on to Buddha. I was dating a woman. She had my son. She broke up with me. I was extremely heartbroken. And then my father passed away. At that point, I was really looking at my life like, what am I going to do with my life? And that's when I chose that I wanted to teach yoga. When I chose I wanted to be a yoga teacher, I don't think I know exactly what I was asking for. But that's what got me on the path. Then I met my first teacher, studied with him, and then I just kept studying. That's what got me onto it. The question then becomes, are you enlightened? And then to answer that question, there are different levels to enlightenment. So have you fully experienced all of your past lives is what the next question is. So in the book here, it says when you master non-attachment. Non-attachment means, number one, I do not own any possessions. I cannot possess anything. Doesn't mean you have to give up your possessions. Doesn't mean you have to go walk on the earth with nothing. Doesn't mean you have to go into homelessness. It just means the intellectual understanding, I do not own this mm-hmm. stuff. Then from there, when you're meditating, you watch the mental impressions arise. So when you're sitting there, memories arise, desires arise, craving arise, and then you watch them go. What it says in the text is that eventually all of the memories from this life, you remember back to your earliest memories, and then the mental impressions from your past lives come up. But to have that realization is very rare, and as far as I know, Siddhartha was the only being who had that realization. So that's, have you had the realization of Siddhartha, or are you enlightened? And they go into the different levels of the jhana states and the samadhi states. So I'm clearing up my karma. Am I in the samadhi and nirvana states? Yes, I've reached them. The final state is called Dharma Mega Samadhi. Dharma Mega Samadhi is when you no longer have any physical crutches whatsoever, and then you never fall back into samsara again. I haven't reached that state yet, but I'm teetering on it.
Nice. Wow. I forgot which kind of Kundalini is it yoga?
Yeah.
So my guru, Sadhguru that I follow, he talked about it, and he's talking about how the West do that, and some people, when they do it without the proper tools, they go crazy, like mentally. Not like, yeah, like something, they go to a space where they don't come back to normalness of what the society would deem as normal. And he says, like, it's good to get the proper, not the Western way of doing it, but the Indian way and the proper way of doing certain things. So how about if you, can someone go through all these levels? I guess if you're going through these levels, you're doing it right, and then you won't go crazy, I guess.
So developing equanimity of mind.
Yeah, because when I was learning a lot of stuff, and I even meditation, I've gone through one point of meditation. I sat there, and when Sadhguru was talking about that, I didn't know it was possible. But he was saying how days would go for him. Days didn't go for me. But hours went by, and I had no idea. I was like, what?
Stick to the eightfold, the eight limbs of yoga. The third limb, asana, is... Everybody thinks asana is all these fancy yoga postures, standing on your hands, standing on your head. Yes, it is. But what it says in the book is the yogi has mastered asana when the body stays calm, strong, comfortable, like effortless effort, and the mind is focused on infinity. Mm-hmm. So as a yogi, developing the strong body and the comfortable body, the relaxed body, is extremely important before you get up into the higher limbs. Because if you don't know how to relax your body, then you can get nervous and you could fall back in and bad things could even happen to you.
Yeah. I don't know what it was, but I was feeling something. And when I got there, something I didn't recognize, I freak out. And then I kind of like woke up. And I never can feel that experience ever again. Because I had this... I guess I want to say normal, but since I'm not used to it and it's something new and I'm practicing, so I was just like, you know, when it's something new you learn and it's exciting, but you still look free, kind of like fear of success, because I'm reaching to a point, it feels great and it's different, but I'm like, oh, maybe I shouldn't go too deep because I don't know what that is. And because of that fear, I guess I could get there again, but I felt like, because every time I'm going to do it again, I have this fear like, oh, I don't think I can obtain that again. Because when I was obtaining it, I didn't have no thoughts about doing it. I had no fear. I was just be. I was like, just be.
The only thing that battles fear long term is one-pointed concentration. So the sixth limb. Mm-hmm. When the fears arise, you watch them arise and you watch them fall. And then after it falls, the only way to battle your next fear is to be completely and totally focused in the present moment. So the Buddha calls this Nirodha. Nirodha, the word nir means pure. So when the Buddha gave the Four Noble Truths, in life there is suffering, there is a cause for suffering, there is a way to stop the suffering, and the cure for the suffering is the Eightfold Path or the Eight Limbs of Yoga. Same difference. Nirodha means the cessation of suffering. And nirvana means pure mind and pure heart. So in order to stop the fears from arising, when the fear drops, there's a moment where there's no fear. Mm-hmm. In that moment, the mind is calm and relaxed. And then if you can stay in that moment for long periods of time, then you're getting close to nirvana.
Nice, yeah. I'm thinking about it, and I've been there a couple of times, and that's a great place to be, certainly.
The first sutra, and again, this is a book that I've read 11 times, and now I've written my own copy. So this is my own translation. So there's 196 sutras, and you're supposed to study them repeatedly. The first one is yoga takes place now, or yoga happens in this moment. So basically what it is you have to always be present in the present moment. The mm-hmm. mind always gets away. It's going here, it's going there. What if this happens? What if that happens? I want this, I want that. So the mind, it's really tricks of the mind. What they say is that the mind gives birth to millions of thought ideas. And these millions of thought ideas keep you going and trapped into this cycle. But if you cut all of the thought ideas out and you come back into simplicity, into the center of the circle, into the center of the soul, then these other things kind of drop off and you're left with nothing but a pure I am consciousness and pure bliss. So going into and going out of this state takes practice. Mm-hmm. That's why it's always recommended practice your asana first before you go into your pranayama and before you go into these limbs. This way, when a nerve-wracking situation arises, you have the ability to keep your body relaxed and calm. Mm-hmm. So the ability to keep the body relaxed and calm is extremely important to develop, because when it comes down to it, when you have these fears, when you have these desires, when you want to act out, when you want to act a fool, when you're going to do something that's going to destroy your life, or when you're in a situation where you're faced with, say, people who are lying about you, talking behind your back, something like that, if you can calm the body, then it kind of just comes and it kind of just goes away. It's very easy. Fight flight. So the body control, that takes time to develop. There's grounding exercises that you can do. There's these other things that you can do as well.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how facts that is, but I was watching something Japanese. I don't know if I pronounced the word correctly. Called Wuwonga, where these people, they meditate or going to limbo. They meditate and then they fall into that space between the spirit world and the human world and they couldn't come back. And so basically they fall into coma for us because they're like, oh, you're in coma, you're dead, but you're alive. But they're trapped. Is that possible? I don't know how mythical that is, but I'm sure anything's possible. But
this book, there's no danger in this book. There's mm-hmm. no danger in this book. I have practiced actually releasing my soul from my body. So I've heard legends from the Dalai Lama where when they were chased out of Tibet, one of the monks went to the side, meditated, and released his soul from his body because he didn't want to leave Tibet. Is it possible to release your soul from your body? I believe so. I believe very high-level practitioners can do that. When it comes your time to die, you're supposed to see, and again, we'll say die, but it's really Bardo. When it comes time to leave the body, you see signs and you know. So if you're in touch spiritually, you know when it's your time to go. And in this practice, you're preparing to release your soul from your body and make a conscious exit into the next life. I have never experienced anybody who went into a coma-like state. I think that's a little bit of talk. I think that's a little bit of a fairy tale. This book is completely and totally safe. You don't have to worry about going into those things. It sounds like overdramaticism to me. Like these people are making something simple into something drama. So uh-huh. I think the drama that's being caused in that is a little bit self-projected. But like when you look at the mythology of the Hydra was a beast with how many heads? Four heads. And if you cut off one of the heads, it would grow back two.
Oh yeah, those, yeah.
So that's kind of like the brain. Like when you cut out this branch, it just grows two back. So it just keeps merging into these different thought forms over and over and over again. So the brain is the intermediary between the soul and the physical world. When the soul experiences the physical world, it gets caught up in it and it believes that it is the physical world, and that causes your first attachment. Then because of that, the soul is confused and the consciousness looks outward. What you're doing is you're bringing the consciousness back into the soul, into the center, and then all of those attachments get cut off. That's why it's so important to study the actual text. I can't tell it to you better than it is in the book. The second sutra is yoga is stilling the mind. The third sutra is then the mind rests within the soul. See? So right now, contemplation, using the brain, right? Think, and that's what it's supposed to be used for, right? Then, well, let me bring it back into the heart. So you sit there and you focus on the heart. and you allow the mind to nestle back into the soul. So that's why the seventh limb is calming the soul. Calming the soul is challenging. The mind is this, that. So for that, it just takes practice. How long have you been meditating? Are you doing your meditation every day? You know, but people, they hear mindfulness, they hear meditation. Well, why? Why are we doing mindfulness? Why are we doing meditation? So for me, coming up as an American, well, why didn't the teachers tell us this? Why didn't the teachers tell us, look, this is your soul? So it was actually Dharma who told me that. So this is the purpose for it, and this is what you do it. But the intellectual understanding without the practice is like peanut butter with no jelly. You're going to end up with a dry mouth. So that's why the intellectual understanding, first, you have to understand intellectually. So it has to be explained in a way where, okay, I understand why I'm doing it. And then you have to practice, and nobody can practice for you. Mm-hmm. Sadhguru can't practice for you. They can guide you. They can point this way. Mm-hmm. Great teachers. I mean, amazing teachers that we have. But are you doing your own personal practice where you're sitting in meditation and you're detaching from the world and you're practicing the eight limbs? Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing. The limbs are limbs. They're not steps. So every time you practice a limb, that limb grows and you get better and better at it. The final limb, samadhi, is like the culmination of a flower in which you bloom out of samsara, the sea of suffering, and you bloom into the sea of spiritual bliss. Mm-hmm.